yourself, show me the feeling. Ah, you got me wrong, if you don't belong, live in the trouble, don't hesitate. Time heals the pain, you ain't the problem. I live the lie, love is the crime, it's you I believe in. No need to blame myself, no need to die, I'm only human. I'm done, you got to put me on, I know when you come along. You are the one, do all the talking. You got me wrong, I caught you falling, I hear you calling. Don't hesitate. Time heals the pain, you ain't the problem. I live the dream, I hope to be who I believe in. I used to hate myself, you got the key, break out the prison. Oh, I hope to never see time passing.
Na, na, na. Welcome to everyone at the Bold Scientist Under the Shower. Here we are like the second Tuesday of every month. From next month will be the second Monday of the month. But for now, we are here. So we are with a new guest. Tonight is a super, super interesting topic. We're going to talk about the ethical impact of new technology with our guest, Tamar Sharon. Hi, Tamar.
Hello.
How are you doing?
Thanks for having me. Good, thanks.
Okay, good. Tamar, she's an associate professor at the University of Nijmegen. And please introduce yourself, because probably you're going to be better than me.
Okay. So I'm an associate professor in what we call philosophy of technology, like you said. And I'm also the scientific director of a new research center at Nijmegen University, which is, we call it the iHub. And it's an interdisciplinary research center on the impacts of digital technologies on society. So we're like philosophers and ethicists, but also computer scientists, legal scholars, social scientists.
So there is a dedicated center.
Yeah, just for this.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, we need much more than one center, but we're starting.
But is that a unique reality in the Netherlands, or there are others?
Well, the Netherlands is a pretty good place for, there's quite a lot of research on technology, which is not from the technology perspective. So social scientists, philosophers, historians studying technology, it's a good place for that. It's also why I came. So I came to the Netherlands about 8 years ago on a postdoc just after my PhD. So I was coming from Israel. And that's one of the reasons I came to the Netherlands. So there's a nice tradition of studying these things.
Okay.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Where have you been?
In the past.
Yeah.
So I have a pretty mixed background. I was born in the U.S.,
okay.
And I lived there till I was 10 years old.
Okay.
But my mother's French and my father is Israeli. So when I was 10, we moved to France and I grew up pretty much in France. And then after high school, I went to Israel. First, just to travel for a year before starting university. Then I went back to France, but then I returned to Israel for what I thought would be a shorter period, but it ended up being kind of 15 years.
Okay.
And then I came to the Netherlands. So okay. I kind of do every 10 years of life, I bounce around.
Somewhere.
I don't know what's next. Okay. Yeah. And then I guess, so my main field of study has been to try to think about these impacts, mostly ethical impacts of new technologies on society. Those happen to be digital today, but they weren't always digital. So, for example, I did my PhD, my dissertation on what we call enhancement technologies, which are any kind of technologies that allow people to improve themselves, say, beyond what's considered normal human functioning. So if that's genetic technologies to kind of make people healthier, but maybe also taller or prettier, or pills that you could take to make you happier, or technologies that allow people to have...
So technology in the most broad sense.
Enhancement technologies would be technologies in the broad sense that allow people to improve themselves beyond what would be considered normal. And then as a philosopher, what I always found very interesting in these technologies is they make you question, yeah, what normal actually is, right? If you can use a technology to go beyond what's normal, what is normal? What does it mean to be human, actually, if that's not something that's fixed, but something that's malleable and can be kind of tinkered with to make it better? So that's the kind of the philosophical questions I was really busy with in my dissertation. And then I moved on to projects. So after my dissertation, I did a lot of research. I had a nice big project on how people who use tracking devices to collect data about their health engage with these technologies, but especially in a kind of political normative context in which people are supposed to be more involved in their health. They're supposed to take more responsibility for their health. And what you get there is you get proponents who think these little devices that help people watch their health are great. They're wonderful because they allow people to become healthier and become more in control of their health. But you get a lot of critical theorists who are saying, well, this is just a kind of neoliberal trick, a means of governments and collectives passing on responsibility from themselves onto the shoulders of individuals. So I was studying that for quite a while, but then going out to actually see how people, what they do with these technologies, talking to people who are really busy quantifying themselves. There's this group called the Quantified Self.
Interesting.
Yeah, I was following them around for quite a while.
How much, let me understand, how much time is wasted kind of? So for We Are in the Radio, I did this kind of thing.
With that was quote unquote.
Wasting their time? Oh, I mean, how much time they were busy with it?
I was interested in like, so what does this give you? What kind of, is this really just about optimizing your life, or is there something else here? Is this really about, so some of the critics of these technologies would say, this is like hyper individualization. What we get is that people get really focused on themselves. It's my health. It's how I sleep. It's what I eat. And then what I found in some of my field work was that actually people, they like doing this in a community. So they like to share this data and share their experiences about collecting data with other people. So this individualization, this fear of individualization, it's a bit different in reality. So those are the types of things I was studying there. It was really interesting.
Interesting.
So I've really always been interested in technologies in this more health and medical related context. So
indeed, we're going to talk about that more in detail later. But for the people that actually don't know exactly, first of all, what the ethics is and what new technology we talk a little bit about. So what exactly means studying the ethical impact on new technology? So
there's kind of a tendency when we think about technologies to think of them like they're these neutral tools, instruments that we kind of pick up and put down, and we use them to fulfill these predetermined goals. But technologies do a lot more than that. They also, when they're introduced into the world, well, they require that people develop new skills. They change relationships between people, if it's doctors and patients, for examples. And they also destabilize
social life.
Yeah, social life. They change. They transform our reality as we use them. And it's really this kind of transformative effect that I'm interested in, which is an interesting impact. So one nice example has been developed by a Dutch philosopher of technology, Peter Paul Verbeek, and he studied the obstetric ultrasound. So the ultrasound is a relatively simple, well, it's not that simple technology, but the idea is...
For us, it's simple.
Let's say. It's not like the internet, right?
Yeah,
or quantum computing. But it kind of allows you to take a peek into the womb, right? It seems like a pretty straightforward thing. But while it does that, it also turns prospective parents into decision makers who have to make decisions now about the life of an unborn fetus. do we abort? Do we not abort? Suddenly we can see things that turn, that that give this new responsibility to parents. And kind of in that instant, the way we think about life has changed. So we think of life more as something which is a choice than something that's governed by just chance or luck or fate, if a baby is born with a deformation or with Down syndrome. So this is a really nice example of how this this whole thinking about life changes, and, I mean, that is mediated by a relatively simple technology.
Exactly. It's even more scary, the fact that I never thought about that. I never thought about such a simple technology.
Yeah.
I mean, for us, it's now very simple thing.
Yeah.
How this thing change our perspective on life.
Yeah. New responsibilities, new understandings of life, new relationships between this fetus, which you can now see and becomes a real thing, right? And the parent. So all of that happens kind of in an instant.
Yes,
it's a really good example. So that's kind of this idea of an impact of a technology and the transformative potential of a technology that I study and other philosophers of technology.
So when we talk about technology, when we talk about, I mean, this is an easy one, probably has been developed in several years, but now we are facing an era where everything, so a lot of application, new startup, tech startup are starting. A lot of new technologies that we don't even know how they work are borning.
Yeah.
So I was wondering whether your job is even more important nowadays, where the technology are really they proceed with a really fast pace, and we need someone like you, someone that will listen to your, result, that can manage to somehow.
Yeah. Well, I don't have that many answers. I'm not a regulator. I do. I'm pretty good at kind of pointing out perhaps what things that may happen, and then helping have a discussion about how we steer things in a proper way. I think you're right that today, more than ever, the omnipresence of technologies in our lives, the closeness of technologies to our lives. I mean, these are on all the time. They're on us. They're sometimes inside us. We're surrounded by them. Makes that this type of thinking is particularly important today. So they're the progress, which is not necessarily a positive term, but the way the development is very fast.
Yeah.
The omnipresence, so the way this is around us, and the impacts of these technologies, I think, are becoming, they're more, maybe morally ambiguous than they were in the past.
Probably the only one that really know the impact that can have in 20, 30 years are the one that developed them.
Because often you have a technology. I mean, what's intended by a designer is hardly how technologies are used in reality.
True.
That might be part of it, but it's not at all. It depends. There's a lot that depends on how users use technologies, and that's kind of unanticipated. You can't know. I mean, people are kind of crazy. They do crazy shit with technologies like everything else. And I mean, the history of technology is full of technologies that were intended for one purpose and are used for very different ones.
That's true.
And might even have what we call revenge effects, where they're used in ways that kind of undermine the original intention of a technology. So that's kind of, on the one hand, completely unanticipated. You can't anticipate it. On the other hand, when you're studying technology for some time and the history of technology, there are things that come back. But another one of the problems, I think, that with this, the speed of it all, is that impacts take a long time to identify. The technologies run faster. Regulation needs to understand impacts. But I mean, privacy is such an important impact today. It took us a long time to understand that privacy is something we value, right?
Yeah,
it's only
now
that we're waking up and saying, privacy is something we care about. But it's only once it's at stake that you kind of realize that. Or like algorithms, right?
True.
So the intention was that they would eliminate human bias or bypass human bias, and we've got new biases.
That's a great so I will stop you here just because we're gonna talk exactly about that, which is a great link to a couple of shows we did here with artificial intelligence and algorithm. So I'm gonna stop here because I'm gonna put a song that actually you asked me to put on, which is Boys, and then you're gonna explain me or us briefly why you chose that. I mean, it doesn't need to be related to the topic, okay. But I mean, just. I didn't ask you actually. Yeah, I'm gonna ask you now whether being a scientist or a philosopher was your childhood dream.
Oh, right. No, not at all. Actually, I had quite a few different childhood dreams. I think the first one was to be an astronaut.
Okay.
But when I was about 10 years old in school, I remember still in the U.S., there was the Spacecraft Challenger. I don't know if you remember that one. It was one that there was a school teacher on board it, and we watched the launch live at school. And after like a minute, it blew up. It exploded on TV.
Oh my God.
And my dream kind of exploded.
That's what Okay.
But then I guess secretly, I always wanted to be a rock star. I told you this would always spoke. Yeah, and I think somehow academia, with the many stage performances that come along with it, responds to this kind of vainglorious need I have.
So whenever you are on a talk, you have a talk in a conference, you feel a bit like being a rock star.
Sometimes I feel a little bit like a rock star.
Okay,
I probably shouldn't say this in public.
That's good. Okay, good. So we leave you with the Boys Don't Cry, great piece from The Cure. Thank you very much for such a nice choice, Tamar.
Thank you.
Boys
for
Don't
it.
Cry. So, which is a bit probably, bit related to the topic, because we should probably cry about those bias that you just mentioned.
Some of them before. Are worth crying about. Yeah,
they were crying indeed. So why did you choose? I don't think you chose this this song for this reason. Probably because
no, not at all. Okay. Actually, as a kind of feminist, I should hate this song because this idea that boys don't cry is horrible. This is just a song I always liked growing up. And I don't really know why. It's just really alive. I like it. There's a contrast between kind of the kick it has and the lyrics, which are pretty depressing.
Absolutely. There was this movie I was telling you about before. It's called Boys Don't Cry. And there's this scene when he cries. And it's nice, the contraposition indeed between the pace of the song and actually the depression.
Yeah.
All right. So you... You were you introduced the one of the topics we want to talk about, namely how artificial intelligence or algorithm did also change the perspective we have on a lot of situation, like also in the health context.
AI is a really nice example of how you kind of introduce these technologies into the world expecting that they do something and something else happens. So there's a lot. I mean, AI has been around for a long time. I don't need to tell you this, but we talked about that with
Raja Thomas in October now. Mm-hmm. So I hope our audience remembers something about that.
They've been around at least since the 80s, right?
Yeah. Actually, we talk about the history. There was this called the AI winter, where because AI actually was discovered much earlier than 20 years ago, in the 80s. But then there was a so-called AI winter because people didn't really understand the power of the technology.
Yeah, and it's made a kind of comeback. So recently have been all these types of breakthroughs that are showing the potential.
Indeed, probably also because the technology, the hardware is there to take advantage of the AI.
Yeah, so it's also raising serious challenges that usually comes with the potential, right? That's kind of a rule of thumb in technology.
Yeah.
And so one of the challenges here we're seeing with AI is the amount of bias that gets introduced, or how vulnerable AI is to bias and discriminatory practices that result from that. And it's pretty complicated how that happens, and I'm not an expert in this, but as far as I understand, I mean, bias kind of creeps into AI, namely because AI requires a lot of data to be trained. And data sets can be, well, bias creeps into there in two ways. So first of all, data sets can be biased, so they can be not representative of reality. So for example, if you have a facial recognition algorithm that's trained on a data set of faces and you have more white faces than black faces in that, the algorithm will inevitably be better at recognizing white faces. And we've seen that with the Google photo app, I think, that tagged some black people as gorillas, right? Now, that's Google Photo, that's one thing, but you can see similar things in healthcare. So something like a melanoma detection app, an app that tries to detect skin cancer, that's been trained on a data set which involves or is made up mostly of light skin, will do less good at identifying melanoma on darker skins. And so what you have here could potentially be an exacerbation of already existing inequalities in healthcare. This is pretty serious. So that's only the first way bias can creep in. Then you also have the situation whereby data sets can be very representative of reality. They're not skewed, but reality is full of bias. It's full of prejudice. So if you're teaching an algorithm on data that's very representative, well, it's going to learn the same biases that exist in reality, the same prejudices. It's going to incorporate them and it's going to spit them back out, maybe even reinforce those. So that's another problem. I mean, reality itself is biased, is full of discrimination. And this is what we're seeing with, for example, there was recently, so this is a story that broke a few weeks ago of an algorithm that's been used across America in many hospitals to allocate which care programs patients are sent to. And they found out studying this that this was quite discriminatory in the sense that for white patients and black patients who were just as sick, it was sending many more white patients to these specialized care programs. And they kind of looked at this and they're like, well, how can this be? The algorithm was optimized, or it used a proxy for high risk, so needing these care programs. It used how much a person costs the healthcare system per year, which is not racist in itself. And the idea is a pretty good assumption. The idea was that, yeah, if you cost a lot of money to the healthcare system, you're probably pretty sick. So those are the people we need to allocate to this program. But when they looked closer at the data, they saw that actually black people who were just as sick as white people or in need of as much care cost less to the system because of, well, racial issues that exist in society. So black people are more suspicious of the healthcare system, so they will go to it less than a white person with the same issues.
Oh, yeah.
And there's some kind of racial discrimination probably amongst healthcare providers. So these things were kind of built into the data set, yeah, the reality data set that the algorithm was trained on, and it kind of spit out these discriminatory practices. So that's a serious issue. Now, we have non-discrimination law, which is pretty good if the discrimination can be seen. But one of the problems is that often these discriminatory practices are algorithmic bias. It's not transparent. So we don't know that it's happening, or the people who are kind of at the end side of decisions that are made by automated decision systems don't know that it's happening. We could try to make things more transparent and more explainable. That would help. But there's another problem here, and this I've learned recently from working alongside a colleague who's a legal scholar.
Because to let me understand this thing of transparency, because if the constraints would be more of the algorithm would be more transparent, people could kind of the one who would design the algorithm could be so it would be easier to change those constraints depending on the result of the algorithm. Or, I mean, external people that...
Some kind of auditing, yeah, say, exactly, to check up on these things. Yeah. That's very important, and people are speaking about that, to keep some kind of human in the loop, so to speak, to supervise this so that so that we can better understand what's going on. And more transparency also as to when these automated decision-making systems are used and for what. So transparency is one dimension of this very big problem. And if things were more transparent, then perhaps non-discrimination law could do the work that it does well. But first, we have to know that this is happening before we can apply the law. To make things more complicated, though, algorithms and AI, one of the strengths of AI is that it creates new categories, right? So the idea is to try to create new categories based on which you can do more personalization, more fine-grained categories. And the categories that are being built may not be using protected characteristics, characteristics that are protected by law, like ethnic minority or like gender. So categories can be based on something like web browser use. That's not something that's protected by law. Or your postal code. Or any combination of many data points. And this is a real problem because that's the strength, in a sense, of these algorithms, but it's also where they are beyond the scope of law. So to give you an example, if an e-shop, a shop online, realizes that people who use one web browser are more willing to pay higher prices than another web browser group, they start effectuating price differentiation. So they let the people who use this web browser pay more. That's not protected by law. It's not, that's not discrimination in the legal terms, but it's very unfair, right? Or we at least intuitively feel that it's unfair. Yeah. So there's a problem here that's beyond the law that needs to be addressed. This is some of the work we're doing at the iHub, at our new center, is to think about, well, what does fairness mean in these different contexts? And what would it mean to have fairer algorithms in something like e-commerce or in health or in policing or in all of these different sectors?
Yeah.
And that's where philosophy has a lot to contribute as well, because fairness, I mean, we kind of think it's intuitively clear and self-evident, but it's not at all. Fairness is very different in different contexts. So if you get a so-called false positive as a wrong advertisement, so you're given an advertisement, I don't know, for skiing, a skiing holiday, but you don't actually like skiing, that's considered a false positive. You've been wrongly targeted. It's not very significant. In the healthcare sector, if you get a false positive, which is, say, the wrong recommendation for diagnosis, that can be fatal. Yeah. Right? So these things will differ in different sectors.
In different fields,
So we need a better grasp and a sense of what fairness is, or what conceptualization of fairness we would use, what theory of justice, but also think about how these differ in different contexts.
Yeah,
it's really a thorny problem.
Yeah, it's well, it's crazy,
it's really
indeed. I find it super interesting the fact that so with transparency, as you point out before, we might solve those categories that are legally that we can legally identify what is discriminatory, what is not. But what about the some new
these new categories?
New categories
The law doesn't protect against.
Okay, so wow, boys. So I'm almost crying. So the song didn't help out, but so it's another good. So actually, the end of this part introduced us very well to the core part of the show, which is still about the ethical impact of new technology and health, but something even more specific that we're gonna talk about in probably a few minutes. Now I'm gonna leave you with a song from a actually an Italian. Singer. I actually watched last week in Brussels. His name is Calcutta, and the song is called Hubner. I chose this song because inside of the main topic of the song is an ethical issue of a man who is who has to decide whether actually becoming a very famous footballer or soccer player, or whether stay home, so going away from his original country, or stay home with his wife and taking care of her. So this song is called Hubner from Calcutta.
Venezia è bella ma non è il mio mare. Il treno è fermo, io sono stufo di aspettare. In questo mondo che è pieno di lacrime, io certe volte dovrei fare come Dario Hübner e non lasciarti a casa mai a consumare le unghie. Stazione di fondi fuori il tuo giubbotto. Scaviamo una buca tutta terra sotto e ci hanno messo le scorie, o forse altre storie. E ci hanno messo le scorie, o forse altre storie. In questo mondo che è pieno di lacrime, io certe volte dovrei fare come Dario Hübner e non lasciarti a casa mai a consumare le unghie. E non lasciarti a casa mai a consumare le unghie. E non lasciarti a casa mai a consumare le unghie.
All right, welcome back to the Able Scientist Under the Shower. There's a long reason for this title.
Yeah.
I will tell you later. It's super long. Anyway, hopefully our general audience knows why. So the name of the show is as such. So probably it's more interesting to go into the core of the show, namely as we mentioned before, addressing the issue of what is called the Googlization of health. What is that?
That's
a bit your
focus. Yeah, I have a pretty big project right now on what I call the Googlization of health. And by that I mean the quite aggressive and fast move of large consumer tech companies, the big ones like Google, Apple, Amazon, Microsoft, IBM, Facebook, into health and medicine. So in the past 4 or 5 years, we've seen that these companies have become very, very interested in medical research and perhaps even beginning to provide healthcare services. And these are companies, right, that up till a few years ago had no interest in health. So this is quite recent. But this is a phenomenon we're seeing. I didn't come up with the term Googlization. Actually, it's a media theorist, Siva Vaidyanathan. I'm not sure how you pronounce his last name. But he wrote a book in 2011 called The Googlization of Everything. And every chapter was kind of dedicated to another aspect of life that was being what he called Googleized.
Like, because it's probably also important to understand how powerful are those. So what are the other Googleization?
The other sectors. Yeah. So I think basically any kind of sector of social life that undergoes digitalization and datification becomes Googleized in a sense. So
like driver's less.
So yeah, we're seeing it started, say, with communications that become mediated by online platforms, transportation, we're moving towards driverless cars, the news that's mediated by digital platforms, education. So Google and Apple have moved quite strongly into education. So any of these fields and all sectors of society basically are becoming digitalized and datafied today. Any of these fields, these companies are kind of experts in data management and enabling data flows. They will become important actors in these fields. So I've gotten interested in how they're moving into health and medical research and looking actually at collaborations that are taking place between public research institutions like hospitals and these companies. So there's quite a few examples of these already. So say in 2014, Apple developed something called the Research Kit. And this is software that allows researchers to carry out medical studies using an iPhone. So the iPhone can be used to collect data. The iPhone sensors can be used. And this is something that's pretty cool, actually, because it allows researchers, first of all, to recruit anyone who uses an iPhone. That's a lot of people. It allows researchers to collect data continuously. So unlike in a, say, traditional clinical trial where a patient would come into a clinic once a month and give blood and samples of other things, these phones, right, they're on us most of the day and sometimes at night collecting data. So it's continuous stream of data. It's also very heterogeneous data, very different types of data. So about how people sleep and eat or what they eat or how they walk, gait, for example, is an important variable in Parkinson's research.
Yeah.
So this is pretty exciting. And we've seen that since 2014, some leading research institutes immediately partnered up with Apple to develop research kit studies. So there are about 20 of these studies now that I think include about maybe more than 100,000 participants on
it
all kinds of
things. Looks pretty amazing, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean,
but
I mean, so yes, there's,
you are the butt.
I'm the butt person. Lots of benefits. I don't think I need to go into the benefits. That's only one thing. That's Apple developing this software. But you get companies that are, of course, very interested in developing AI for medical, for the medical field. So Alphabet, the mother company of Google, is really busy doing this. So they have DeepMind, that's an artificial intelligence offshoot. which is busy developing some applications for medicine, for like identifying risk of diabetes, eye disease, cardiovascular disease, breast cancer. Google is busy developing these things. So AI is another, say, benefit that these companies bring to the table.
So there is some sharing of information either with a single private person or sharing with the general public hospital. Sharing data.
Yeah, these are happening in different ways. So I call this Googleization of health. It's a very general trend, let's say, but there's different types of partnerships taking place. There's different companies play different roles in different types of collaborations. They're offering sometimes just some infrastructure, sometimes just a device on which data can be collected, sometimes cloud infrastructure, which is also becoming very important. So medical researchers are kind of moving all of this data, which is very big data, into Google clouds, into Amazon clouds. So they're doing very different things there. But this is all happening very quickly again. Yeah, and exactly. And I'm here to say, but let's think about, okay, what are the risks involved here? Or what are the challenges, let's say? What in which ways do these challenge?
So the challenge is the polite way of saying risks, right?
Yeah, it's the more nuanced, yeah.
Okay.
what are the challenges?
Okay.
And there are quite a few. I mean, so there's great benefits. I always like to specify that. It's not to say that this is all, it's not all bad. There are many benefits to be reaped, but we need to be careful how this takes place, because what it is really, this Googleization of health, it's kind of emerging at the intersection of two worlds that used to be quite separate, and that's health or digital health and capitalism, digital capitalism. So these things are merging, and that means we're going to see many of the issues that are being played out in digital capitalism or online imported into the health and medicine area. And that's pretty worrisome. So, of course, one of the main concerns here is privacy, right? Will these companies start selling all of this data they have access to third parties for targeted advertising or to insurers? Mm. I mean, we know the scare stories. And the truth is, the reputation of most of these companies, Apple is pretty good at privacy, but other ones like Facebook, if you think of Cambridge Analytica, the reputation and the practices are very not privacy friendly. So you can expect some issues there.
But there are some companies who take care of the privacy, like you said.
Yeah, Apple. So Apple is pretty good at that, as far as I understand. And this is what some of my kind of more tech-oriented friends say. For example, if you think about the research kit, Apple said, for privacy reasons, it does not want to handle the data that the phone collects for these studies. So basically, the data stays on the phone, it doesn't go to Apple, and then you're going to have some kind of mediating partner, some kind of data repository where the data can go and be made accessible to researchers. So Sage BioNetworks is an organization like this, a nonprofit organization that created the kind of data repository for the first of these research kit apps. So Apple's not involved in seeing the data, so to speak. So that's pretty good privacy related. One of the collaborations we're looking at is happening at my university at Radboud between the University Medical Center and Verily. Verily is the life sciences branch of Alphabet, a sister company of Google. And they brought in an internationally renowned group of cybersecurity specialists to develop the data sharing system, which would be very privacy friendly. It's called PEP.
So apparently, then what I understood is privacy is an issue, but it's probably not the main one, or at least it's a big one.
It's a very big one. And
there's already a lot of awareness about this.
Well, there's awareness, but there's reason to be concerned. So there was recently this Nightingale project that we've heard about a couple of weeks ago, which is a partnership between Google and Ascension, which is a large company that runs, I don't know, like 150 hospitals in the United States. And they allowed Google to access patient data on like 50 million people without their people's consent. And as far as I know, the data hasn't really been de-identified either. So there are privacy breaches. There are reasons to be concerned about privacy. I think that privacy is... I think that privacy is kind of the tip of the iceberg here when we're thinking about what the challenges at stake are. So I think we need to be asking other questions. Questions like, will these companies have some kind of gatekeeping role of who's allowed to access data sets that they're helping generate? Will these companies have a role in setting research agendas and starting to ask research questions? And we know in the philosophies of science that who asks questions in science determines which questions get asked. What business models are at stake when, you know, these are very valuable data sets that are perhaps being handed over to private companies to develop, of not handed over, but if access is allowed, maybe they're developing proprietary algorithms on these that will then be sold back to the public sector. So these are questions that have to do more with something like societal or collective benefit, and they move beyond privacy. So we may have very privacy secure collaborations, and some of these questions will remain. The biggest of these questions being, I think, what does it mean that power is amassed across the sectors? So if this is happening in transportation and in education and in communications and in health, what does it mean when that kind of comes together? And we've got to think, in a sense, in a broader than just health and medicine here, broader than each one of these sectors.
It is quite scary. I was just telling you that we actually run, so the time really flies because it's just 7 minutes, so only seven minutes are left. That's what I was telling you behind the lines. We're gonna continue for 5 minutes more, and then we put the last song, which would be what you choose was
Airbag.
Yeah, okay, so it would be our last song.
Get to say more before the song?
Couple of those issues that you mentioned besides the privacy, for instance this thing of the business model or the fact that they might use the data in such a way in order to probably create some pharmaceutical drugs or algorithms that can change in positive our life, but at which price?
I think that's the big question. What is the trade-off? How do we kind of lay down some conditions so that we reap the benefits of this, which may be better medical research, it may be better medical treatments and improved health outcomes, but what is the what do we lose along the way? And I think what we lose is not just about privacy. So there's questions about democratic control over a common good. There's something to be said for transparency and fairness here as well. I think that's the big question. Well, even if we gain better health, are we losing something along the way?
Yeah, indeed. But who can act upon those huge lobby, actually, also those huge companies that...
I don't know who it's up to. So the work that I'm doing and the research project I'm running, and we're four people working on this together, is first to kind of map what the common good means here. And we're seeing that there's also different conceptions of the common good, and what would it mean that one understanding of the common good would drive all of this, and what the trade-offs are there. So that's already something that needs to be done. This question of trade-offs opens up a space to deliberate about what we want healthcare and medical research to look like and which values we want to be driving it. But that's a discussion that's not really being had.
Yeah,
and that's a discussion that has to include medical researchers who are involved, but it's not up to them to lay down these conditions. Yeah. I think indeed regulators, policymakers need to get involved to see this as something that's a reshaping of society in general. So how do we allow, kind of reap the benefits again that these companies can bring because they have some serious technical expertise that can be useful, but lay down some conditions based on something like the common good and democratic control over this good and social value. So that's a very difficult thing, but I think that should be the aim.
And actually, probably you already answered to my final question, the one I ask to my guests. So is that probably the relevance of your work, the reason that we actually mentioned through the show, the reason that, that a government should finance this type of research?
Yeah, sure. I mean, luckily they already have, financing for the research. I like to think that the reason I've been successful in that is also because government bodies like the European Union funding research understand to some extent that these transformations that society is undergoing as we become more and more digital and datafied need to be driven by some kind of normative vision.
So is Europe aware in this regards? I mean, more or less than US?
I think Europe is a bit more on the kind of ethics. I mean, there's a lot of ethics whitewashing going on, of course, but I think in a rock and a hard place between China and the United States, Europe is the better place to for funding research on ethics and technology.
Good. So I will end up here because, I mean, it's probably good to end up with I mean, a happy, happy message. I mean, some hope.
Yeah.
For the future. Yeah. I thank you. Thank you a lot for being here.
Thank you. For
it's been
me.
Super interesting, actually. Yeah. I mean, as you saw, the time really.
Flew.
Oh my God.
Yeah.
Okay. Great. So I will leave you with the airbag. I thank Radio Italiana to having host us also today. Merry Christmas to everyone, actually, because next time will be in January. And okay, so I will leave you with Airbag. So a couple of seconds, tell me why did you choose this song?
Ah, this song. So OK Computer is an album I love. This is the first
song.
Yeah,
me too.
And it's really, you listen to this album and it seems to be a lot of foreshadowing of kind of the soul in the digital era and this kind of over-reliance on technology. That's not what they intended, which is interesting, but it's very much read as being a record about these things, these kind of laser guitars. And it's the more dystopic side, so we try to end hopeful. This is not hopeful, but it's kind of an over-dramatization of that. I love it.
But I mean, we had our hope part before. Okay, thanks a lot. I mean, I hope to see you probably next year here to talk about something else, other interesting topic. And see you next month. Bye.
Bye.